Okay, so take me through the day you leave.
I woke up early in the morning, really early, like maybe 5-6 o'clock, because our flight left at like 12 o'clock. We just wanted to be there early. I had to make an excuse as to why I was going. It was during the holiday, so I was just like, I have extra classes that I need to go to because I had my GCSEs coming up, and my mum believed me. She walked me to the bus stop. I just stood there with her, you know, just being quiet and stuff. She was just staring at me and not saying anything. I just said bye to her and I got on the bus and I left. I feel really guilty, obviously, not giving her a better goodbye, knowing that I would probably never see her again. I just got on the bus to Khadija's house. I picked her up. We went and met Amira, and then we just went to the airport. Our bags were already somewhere else, like hidden somewhere else.
And had ISIS told you to do that?
Yeah.
At the airport, What's going through your head?
I felt like I was not inside my body. It felt like a dream, almost. That was one of the scariest moments of my life, just handing the passport over to the man and him just, like, not even looking at it, just gliding it past and handing it back to me and telling me to go. Like, I probably looked guilty, but he just did not even look at me to see that I looked guilty. And my friends looked scared too because of what was happening.
Do you think you're ever coming back to Britain?
Really, at that time, I just was not thinking. My mind was, like, completely blank. But I guess, yes, I thought, this is the last time I'm going to see the UK.
Did that worry you?
I mean, in a way, I felt kind of relieved.
So these are the images of the girls that the police have released. They're very young, they're 15, so they're still in school. I've had several conversations with various individuals, with the police and the local authority as well. It's been kind of manic since I woke up this morning.
It's February 2015, and I'm in East London Mosque. I've been here for months filming a documentary, following people like Salman, its head of communications.
So this is basically what happens. An incident occurs and then we're almost on the front line. Press obviously want to hear what the Muslim community have to say about this.
Three schoolgirls from the community have just gone missing. They left their homes early in the morning, heading for the airport, apparently on their way to Syria to join the terror group ISIS. This is the moment I first become aware of the Shamima Begum story. It would lead me to spend the next 8 years as an investigative journalist, specialising in conflict and terrorism. But right now, I'm with Salman, as he's inundated with calls.
What's your angle? You want to cover it for BBC Regional News this evening, right? News
no, for the 6 and 10 o'clock.
For
news.
6 and 10 o'clock, okay. Oh, you know what? Sorry, 1 second. I'm just going to put you on hold, okay. Yeah? Hi, can I call you back? I'm on another line at the moment. I'm going to call you back. My phone is just popping off right now. It's just going crazy.
I follow Salman as he races across the mosque's grand marble floors and then down the grey carpeted corridors of the administrative offices.
So let's go speak to LBC and see if there's anything we can do to help.
He's trying to deal with the deluge of attention created by the girl's disappearance.
Right.
He checks his emails. His eyes go wide. Then he dials a number at the bottom of the message.
This is Salman calling from the East London Mosque. Are you okay? Is this to do with news that broke today? It is. So is that your sister? One of the individual? Okay. Is it possible for you to come and visit me at the mosque? No?
No.
Why not?
It's the older sister of Shamima Begum, one of the missing schoolgirls.
Okay.
She wants the mosque's help, but says her home is besieged by the media and she can't go outside.
All right, inshallah. Look, we're going to do our best. We're going to do everything that we can, just so that you're comfortable. We've already had conversations with the police, and we're going to try and get them to do as much as they can to bring them back here. And if you need anything from us, Don't cry, don't cry. Please, don't cry. We'll do everything that we can, yeah? Okay? All right. I'll let you go now. That's sad, man. That was hard. Oh, man. This is messed up. Oh, I don't know what to say. I'm hoping that they're all right, they're safe. Because I see them as my own sisters. I've got younger sisters, and it's so personal. You know, it could be anybody's sister.
Police have issued an urgent appeal for help in finding three schoolgirls from London who are believed to be trying to join jihadists fighting in Syria.
They were last seen at their homes on Tuesday morning. At that point, they didn't give their families any reasons to be worried.
After this, the three missing girls are 16-year-old Khadiza and 15-year-olds Amira and Shamima.
And Scotland Yard fears they may be making their way to Syria.
Well, the British police are launching this international appeal because the hope is that they haven't gone in yet. So authorities.
Firstly, it was national news, and then it became like CNN, NBC, France 24, even the Chinese state broadcaster. When it was running day in, day out, and every news media outlet in the world that you can think of wanted a piece of it. You know, you kind of get a sense that this is huge and the public interest in this story is huge.
Everyone scrambles to find out where the girls are and if they can be stopped. But it's all too late. They're on their way to join ISIS, a brutal terror group.
ISIS, once again, is flaunting its uncompromising brutality.
Captive women bought and sold.
Men herded together and executed in mass.
The girls enter Syria and vanish. Out of touch and out of reach. At this point, the story kind of stops. It drops out of the news because it's hard to know what they're doing or if they're even still alive. Until almost 4 years later, when one of the girls emerges from the ashes of the so-called caliphate and is catapulted back into the media.
We're talking about Shamima Begum.
Shamima Begum.
Shamima Begum.
Shamima Begum.
Shamima Begum.
Shamima Begum.
The extraordinary story of Shamima Begum.
Big, big. As a journalist, you get excited about these stories. In one way, she's back from the dead.
Shamima Begum is found in a Syrian detention camp where she gives birth to a baby boy. She's 19 years old, desperate to come home, but shows little remorse about joining ISIS, a group responsible for genocide.
I don't regret it because it's changed me as a person. It's made me stronger, tougher. You know, I married my husband. I wouldn't have found someone like him back in the UK.
Her comments enrage the public, and the British government takes away her citizenship to stop her returning to Britain.
So you maintain there is a national security risk.
Let me say this. I think if you did know what I knew, you would have made exactly the same decision. Of that, I have no doubt.
The government minister who took away her citizenship says she's a threat to national security and that there's something about Shamima Begum that we don't know. Claims circulate in the press that she was a cruel enforcer for the Islamic State group and that she helped make suicide vests. But she denies it. Her fate becomes a national talking point, debated in pubs, on panel shows, radio phone-ins, and even comedy programmes.
When I was 15, I used to watch a lot of Dawson's Creek. I should say, you know, it was a teenage phase, but I can't really say it with ISIS.
You all said that she was a victim. What's changed is the last 4 years.
Do you have any sympathy for her?
No, not much, really.
She left the comfort of this country to be with terrorists.
She was radicalised in this country, and she needs us right now, and she doesn't...
No, there is no room for do-gooders.
Yeah, she's 19, she's still somebody's little girl.
Jane emails and says, the girl is a traitor, it'll be the biggest...
Was she trafficked? Injustice. Was she groomed?
Now, you said she should rot in hell.
She should be done for treason, and she's a risk for this country.
How about
China, Bobby Gully's brother.
It's been 4 years since Shamima Begum was found. I'm sheltering from the oppressive heat inside a Toyota Land Cruiser. An armed guard stares at me from a nearby tower as we wait to pass through a security gate.
Yeah, he says, like, a minute and you'll get me.
Where you go?
Whenever I come here, I sit in the same featureless white air-conditioned room. Cheap, stiff, bulky armchairs are positioned against the walls. In the centre is a long glass coffee table that's covered in refreshments. Everything from bottled water to those fruit juices that contain enough sugar to dissolve your teeth. The room is in a Syrian detention camp. And it's where I've come to meet Shamima Begum, the girl I first heard about at East London Mosque back in 2015. Did they come and wake you up?
Yeah. I was just about to start working out and then she came. I was like, thank God.
You do a workout?
Yeah. Just do steps and squats and, like, run in my tent. Just run on the spot.
Shamima's just been brought in by a guard who listens as we talk. She lives in a dusty tent near the camp's perimeter fence. This place is sort of purgatory for her. She's unable to go back to Britain and unable to go anywhere else. She's one of thousands of women, men and children who are with ISIS and are now held in Syria, often from countries that don't want them back. They're kind of the world's unwanted.
This is, I feel like, worse than a prison sentence because it's, at least with prison sentences, you know that there will be an end, but here you don't know if there's going to be an end.
Do you have any idea of how long you might be held here or anything of that notion?
Indefinitely, I guess. I don't know.
Now she's in a legal battle with the British government to try to have her citizenship restored so she can return to London. Out of all the people here, her case is the most talked about.
I'm curious about how you think people perceive you.
As a danger, as a risk, as a potential risk to them, to their safety, to their way of living. I'm not a bad person. I'm not this person that they think I am being perceived as in the media. You know, I'm just so much more than ISIS and I'm so much more than everything that I've been through.
But do you understand why society has so much anger towards you?
Yes, I do understand. But I don't think it's actually towards me. I think it's towards ISIS, but when they think of ISIS, they think of me because I've been put on the media so much.
But they only did that because you chose to go to ISIS.
But what was there to obsess over? We went to ISIS, that was it. It was over. It was over and done with. What more is there to say? Like, they just wanted to continue the story because it was a story. It was the big story.
But you do accept that you did join a terrorist group?
Yes. I did.
Shamima Begum has never done interviews like this before. We've been talking for well over a year, and she's given me what she says is her full story. So I've been investigating what she's told me, where she went, who she met, and retracing her journey to see if she's telling me the truth. Figuring out what really happened has taken me from a London bus stop to a theme park in ISIS's former stronghold. Along the way, I've sat with terrorists, met with spies, and tracked down people who knew her when she was with ISIS. Because there are different ways to tell the Shamima Begum story. There's the one about a schoolgirl who was groomed and lured to a war zone by ISIS and now needs saving from a detention camp. And then there's the one about a traitor who chose to join the group and must be stopped from ever coming back to Britain. Someone known the world over as a terrorist and a monster. So I want to know, who is Shamima Begum? I'm Josh Baker, and from BBC Sounds and Radio 5 Live, this is The Shamima Begum Story, Series 2 of I'm Not a Monster. Episode 1, It Felt Like a Dream.
Smart.
Neat.
Yeah.
I'm in London with Taz, an impeccably dressed lawyer. Tweed three-piece suits are his thing, and he functions largely on a diet of Red Bull and cigarettes. We head into his office. There are cabinets stacked high with books that you'd expect with any lawyer. On the wall are a pair of boxing gloves signed by Muhammad Ali. Then there's his desk, which has the biggest computer monitor I've ever seen.
Yeah, it's just got loads of documents open at the same time so I can cross-refer things.
That's brilliant.
Your whole setup looks more like a Boeing 737 than a desk.
Well...
And then your room hasn't changed much, except there's no...
Taz and I spent a lot of time together back in 2015. We met just after Shamima and her friends disappeared.
So I was thinking what would be good is to almost sort of like go back to the beginning, work our way forward.
Sure.
When was it that you first became aware of the girls?
Got a phone call from Salman from East London Mosque. He's a friend of mine and he's never asked me for anything before. And he was crying. And he just said, before I say anything, I'm going to ask you a favour and you have to say yes. So I said yes.
Salman is the guy I was filming with in East London Mosque back when the girls disappeared.
And what did he say?
He said, there are some families here, they've lost their kids, they think they're going to Syria, and you have to help stop them or bring them back.
And why would Salman pick you?
Well, I've known him for a while, and he knew that I was involved in doing quite a lot of work with terrorism cases. And so that means that you have a reach into various communities that other people may not necessarily have a reach into.
Taz agreed to help. He began by searching the girls' homes for clues. I want to know if he can tell me anything about how Shamima's journey to ISIS began.
The reason I'd gone there is because I wanted to try and find out if there's any scraps of any information that would help us work out if the girls were in contact with anybody. That was the plan. There were no receipts, there's no phone bills. Most of their clothes were in place. There was no indication of any sort of planning, any sort of outside contact on anything written or electronic.
What does that tell you?
Well, I'm a criminal lawyer that's been working for about 20 years, and I deal with criminals on every level. And criminals tend to want to avoid being caught, but I'd never seen anything so thoroughly dry-cleaned of evidence or information as had these young teenagers managed to do themselves. So that was very, very surprising to me.
How would they obtain the knowledge to do that?
Well, they wouldn't have been able to do that on their own. That, to me, told me that they had been very strongly advised and very professionally advised on steps to take to avoid detection, and they'd also adhere to those steps in a very careful way. Now, that in itself is noteworthy.
Why?
Well, it shows a level of commitment. So these were intelligent girls who were committed to a plan to leave, and also that they must have had a great deal of trust in whoever it is that they were speaking to follow their advice very, very carefully.
Taz suspected the girls had been given clear instructions about how to cover their tracks and that they put real effort into following that advice, leaving nothing behind. Well, almost.
Now, in Shamima's house, she wasn't maybe as careful as the others. There was a scrap of paper that we found with a shopping list on that.
Taz pulls up a picture of the list on his massive screen. It's written in what looks like a school planner. On the left-hand side, there's a series of items, a bag, makeup, boots. And next to each item is a name or initial. There's S&K, presumably for Shamima and her friend Khadija. There's an A for Amira, marked next to vests. Then on the right-hand side is what looks like how much each item will cost. There's a phone for £75, socks for £4, taxi for £100. It's an itemised list of what they think they'll need for a trip to the so-called caliphate. There's even money marked down next to the word billet, which happens to be Turkish for ticket. The list shows that Shamima and her friends didn't just run off to ISIS. They had a plan.
So January 2015, you're planning to go to ISIS. How do you learn what to do?
people online telling us and, like, advising us on what to do and what not to do. Just like how to get the money to buy the tickets, where to buy the tickets, which airport to go to, what to bring, what to wear when you're going to the airport, who to talk to, who not to talk to, what excuse to make if you do get caught, you know. I mean, it was just like a long list of detailed instructions.
There's a lot of debate about how much agency Shamima Begum had in her journey to ISIS. Some people say she clearly chose to go. Others that she was manipulated by the terror group. I'm curious about how Shamima explains the list that Taz found. After you left, a list was found in your bedroom. And it was just...
That was not found in my bedroom. That was found in Amira's bedroom.
I thought it was found in your bedroom.
Trust me, we all looked at it. We were like, this is Amira's handwriting. This is Amira's dumbness, leaving this kind of stuff around. That was not me.
Hold on, you all looked at it. So when are you all looking at it?
There was a picture of it on the internet. And we all like, let's examine this and see who is the culprit. It was just a dumb moment. We were like, we tried so hard to be so... to, you know, clear up our tracks. And yet, you know... just one of us was stupid.
Were people then being like, oh my God, why did you leave the list? Or what was it?
No, they were just like, so embarrassing.
Why was it embarrassing?
You know what the contents of the list is.
It also included the travel costs for getting to Syria.
Mm-hmm.
How did you know how much things were?
You look it up online.
Nobody told you, you just looked it up?
No, yeah, we just looked it up online.
You may not remember this, but it says the word bilet, which is Turkish for ticket. Where did you learn that?
Again, online.
Again, you looked up... So you
can just Google it, yeah.
You were looking up Turkish language stuff?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
You were thinking that far ahead?
Yeah, of course.
Like how to communicate in Turkey and things like that?
Mm-hmm.
So it sounds very planned out.
It was, obviously.
As Shamima tells me this, I'm surprised by how candid she's being. She clearly went out of her way to look up information herself. And she also tells me that she and her friends looked for ISIS members online to help them plan their journey. So she wasn't just a passive participant, but she does appear to have been fed detailed instructions about what to do, and she was just 15 years old. How do you decide what items to take with you?
I mean, it's the same as when you go on vacation. You're just like, what do I need for a vacation? It's pretty basic items. Because I couldn't take much, because obviously I want to take like a suitcase full of stuff. So I'd had to like minimalize everything. I know people used to say like pack nice clothes so you can like dress nicely for your husband, but I was like, I don't know what that means.
Did you buy anything else?
I'm not gonna lie, I took candy.
Candy?
I took candy. I just like bought candies that I knew I would not find in Syria.
Like what?
You know, Aero, mint chocolate. Like a lot.
How much is
a lot? I don't even know. Like 30 bars.
You took
30? Not those big bars, but like, you know, the ones with the like four inside. You can find a lot of things in this country, but you cannot find mint chocolate. And it's a tragedy. It's a tragedy.
I feel like I'm getting a glimpse into 15-year-old Shamima. She's talking as if she's going away on a girls' holiday. Not to a country that's being ripped apart by civil war. I want to speak to someone who knew her before she left, that can tell me more about who she was back then.
Is it a bit bait if you call me by my middle name?
I mean, we can call you whatever you want.
Let's call me Zara.
Zara?
Yeah.
Okay, so we're going to call you Zara. Can you tell me, like, how you knew Shamima Begum?
So, we went to school together. We used to go to the prayer room together, I used to see her there, and I just used to see her about.
I've met Zara by the side of a river. She's asked me not to reveal who she is or where we are, because of how she feels us journalists handled the Shamima Begum story back in 2015.
After they left, I remember we were bombarded at bus stops by journalist paparazzi, and then school had to literally chaperone us onto the buses. That's how bad it was. It was a bit like intimidating. You felt a bit weirded out.
We continue our chat inside. away from the skateboarders that appeared as soon as I hit record. I ask about Shamima's school days.
I used to see her in the prayer room, see her in the playground.
What would you guys do together in the prayer room?
Pray. But then the prayer room was pretty much a social sort of place for all of us Muslim girls, you know. It was more of like a place where everyone can come together, a place of comfort. Actually, funny story, we used to get in trouble a lot for just hanging out in the prayer room. Whilst people are praying, we used to just hang out in the prayer room. So the teachers used to come in and literally hoard us out. They're like, it's a prayer room only for praying. You can't sit there and chat, blah, blah, blah. So it was a bit of a sisterhood.
Tell me about what the three girls were like. Like, what was Shamima, okay, Khadija and Amira like?
So, all three of them were quite nerdy. They were very book smart. Amira, she was bubbly. She's very outspoken. She was in different clubs, societies. She was even on, like, posters and stuff around the school. It's quite strange that she was friends with the other two, but I guess in a friendship group, you have quite a mixture of personalities, which is why they all got along. Khadija was really tall, like freakishly tall for her age. God bless her, because, you know, being Bengali, we're not that tall. We're not blessed with that genetic, you know. And she was quite beautiful, if I'm honest. So she used to stand out in that sense. On the other hand, Shamima, she was a ghost, literally a ghost. Like, I could hear a pin drop louder than her voice. She was very to herself within her own little friendship group. She seemed like she was in her own bubble.
She wasn't a big presence then?
No, not at all, no.
As Zara tells me this, I'm kind of struck by how ironic it is that Shamima, a shy girl who seemed to have largely kept herself to herself, ended up known around the world, infamous for running away from home to join ISIS. And it's an irony that's not lost on Shamima either.
I have always been a more secluded person. That's why it's so hard, the way my life has turned out, being all over the media, because I'm not that type of person that likes to have a lot of attention on me. I don't even like to have birthday parties because I don't like that much attention on me. My family thought I was too, like, weak to do something so crazy. They did not think in a million years I could do that because of my personality.
Okay, so the day you leave, you sat on the tarmac waiting for the plane to take off.
We're on the plane and it was delayed because of the snow in Turkey, and we started getting nervous because we told our families we'd be back home at 4 o'clock, and then the plane goes.
Now, let's talk more about that story that's been developing just in the last hour or so. Three teenagers from East
London... girls left their homes, lying to their parents about their plans. At Gatwick, they boarded a Turkish Airlines plane for Istanbul.
We are confident that if they can contact us, that we will be able to get them back with their families safe in this country.
After the girls leave the UK, they fly to Turkey and make their way to Istanbul bus station. I've got CCTV from the station that shows them trudging through a snowstorm. There's a mirror, hood up, head down. She holds open a glass door to a ticket office. Her friend Khadija looks from side to side before walking in, perhaps to see if anyone's watching. The third girl follows. She's wearing a headscarf and is hunched forward. It's Shamima.
When we got to the coach station, we, like, changed our clothes. We, like, dressed a bit more Islamically. There was a huge blizzard and we were all getting really nervous. While the world was looking for us, we were just in the coach station, yeah. And then we contacted the smuggler who's going to help smuggle us across the border. It was so scary. It was so scary because at that point we were in unknown territory.
So far, Shamima Begum's planning has paid off. She's made it through airport security, out of the UK, into a country that borders Syria. In many ways, this has been the easy bit. Now, Shamima and her friends are dependent on one man, a smuggler sent by ISIS, who's far more dangerous than they realise. You've been listening to the Shamima Begum story, series 2 of I'm Not a Monster. Please share, rate and review the show. It really does help. And you can email me on josh@bbc.co.uk. I'll be discussing each episode on BBC Radio 5 Live at 11:30 UK time every Wednesday. Wednesday is also when new episodes will appear on BBC Sounds or wherever you get your podcasts. The series is written by me, Josh Baker, and Joe Kent. We produced it together with Sarah Obidat. Our production manager is Janet Staples, series editor Jonathan Aspinwall, composer Firas Abu Faker. The theme music is by Sam Slater, and it's all mixed by Tom Brignall. The head of BBC News Long Form Audio is Emma Rippon, and at BBC Sounds, the commissioning executive is Dylan Haskins.